On behalf of the Newhall Family Theater and Mark II Entertainment, welcome to the extended interview of Talking Backstage. I'm your host, Tom Lund. Today's guest is someone I've known since high school, Brianna Shea Mowry. Brianna is the band and choral teacher at Sierra Vista Junior High School. As the band and choral teacher, she teaches her students music theory, performance techniques, and directs their performances. In this episode, Brianna shares with us some stories of her time as a student at Saugus High School, as well as the importance of arts education in our community. Hi, Brianna. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So first question, what schools did you attend in Santa Clarita?
So I was practically born and raised here. I went to Boca Canyon Elementary, which no longer exists, which is kind of funny.
Oh, that's right.
Arroyo Seco Junior High School. And I graduated from Saugus High School in 2006.
Fantastic. And then did you do any classes at COC too?
Yeah, I did 2 years at COC and transferred to Cal State University Northridge.
Fantastic. So how old were you? What grade were you in when you first started getting involved with the arts?
I would say that eighth grade was probably my first real introduction to the arts in school. When I was in elementary school, I did piano lessons for a little while. And then when I hit junior high, it was like too hard for me to juggle a new school and lessons and practicing. And so I kind of put that aside. And a dear family friend of mine kind of coerced me into joining theater when I was in eighth grade. And so my first ever production was of Oklahoma. And I didn't have a role with a name that I can remember. I just know I had a lot of solos. So I thought like, oh, maybe I can sing. Not so sure about the acting. Who knows? But I was like, thank goodness there's no video evidence of that that I know of. But yeah, so I was an eighth grader. I was about 13 when I did my first production.
And going into junior high, you said you were taking piano lessons. Was music like part of your life beforehand, like from your family?
Not really. So I knew that my dad could kind of play the guitar. I know my mom sang in church, but like she never really talked about it until I showed interest in joining choir when I got into high school. And for us, like music was purely like we had a piano. I played piano. And so I loved doing that. I was never very good at it, but I enjoyed doing it. And beyond like singing along to Disney films, like music was not really a thing that wasn't just a school requirement.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. So then once you got into high school, were you involved with the arts there?
Oh, absolutely. That same family friend, shout out to PJ Bobby, said that if he was going to audition for choir, that I had to do it too. And so I was like, sure, I like singing. I'll do that. So I was in concert choir at Saugus High School from freshman through senior year. I did a year of jazz choir and I did probably 2 years or 2.5 years of theater.
Yeah. So tell me about your experience with choir, because that's where we met, obviously, was choir at Saugus when your freshman year. Do you remember how many freshmen were admitted to concert choir that year?
I think it was just three of us. I know that April. Okay. So weird to call her April. April Dooley, who's the director. Now that we're adults and we can call each other by our first names. It's so strange. I know that April did not like to take freshmen in choir if she didn't have to. And so I immediately was in this place of like, oh, I have this great responsibility that I'm a freshman in this like elite group. But yeah, there were only three of us. And I think one of the three didn't stay the whole year, but I know PJ and I stayed the entire time. I think it was easier to be a boy as a freshman than it was to be a girl as a freshman.
Yeah, I can attest to that because I was one of the three freshmen that was admitted to concert choir as well. And kind of like you, I wasn't really like known as being a singer or anything like that going into high school. And just like you, I had friends that are like, we're auditioning for choir, you should too. And I was like, but I'm a theater kid, not a choir kid. And I got coerced into auditioning and then I made it into concert choir. And, you know, the rest is kind of history. What were some of your favorite memories from singing in choir at Saugus?
So my parents, like we grew up, we didn't have a ton of money to like travel and to go places and see things like outside of California or road trips to see family in Idaho. So I think my favorite part of being in choir was how much we got to travel. And we would go, I mean, all over Southern California to these colleges I'd never heard of and I'd never seen. We went to Florida. We went to New York City. We got to go places and see things, which I never really had the chance to do. And I had never really like sung with groups of people. Like when you're in musical theater as a little kid, like, you know, 13-year-old and newly kind of dipping your toes into this pond, it's really, you're not really singing and harmonizing with people successfully. I'll admit that. But in choir, it's like the range of ages when you're in high school makes it so fun because you get to feel that feeling of like, oh no, we're harmonizing, we're singing together. And it's all these different levels of kids. And I remember Karen Huell sort of like took me under her wing a little bit and was so kind to me and like helped me understand like what choir was like and what it was about. And so I loved that. It was so easy to make friends. And we spent so much time together. Like it was incredible. It felt like every day at lunch, every day after school, plus class time, we were constantly with each other.
Yeah, I think that's one of the cool things about the arts is you do get to have that experience. It's almost like the big little relationships that you see in like fraternities and sororities and stuff like that. Because it's very much the same thing. My freshman year, Kevin Han was a senior and he was the one that kind of took me under his wing and showed me the ropes to choir. So it's nice to hear that you had a similar experience with that.
Yeah, it was great. And I know when I was a senior, I'm sure I tried to return the favor of like finding a young person to be like, come join us,
right?
Be indoctrinated in the club.
Yeah, exactly. So when did you decide that you wanted to go into teaching and specifically teaching music?
I would say that I didn't know. I didn't know at first. okay. I thought like, my dad wants me to be responsible. I want to be on Broadway. Like it became this thing of, you know, I kind of expressed to my parents that I wanted to be a performer and they were like, well, you need to have a plan B. And so it was probably like in 10th grade. I was like, I'm going to be a star. And then as I got older and I started working, I had more roles within the choir at school. Mm-hmm. I felt like actually I really like helping other students. I was a section leader. I really wanted to teach my fellow section their notes. And I really enjoyed spending that time doing one-on-one work and small group work. And I went like, ow, actually, I kind of like this way more than I like performing. Mm-hmm. And that sort of planted the seed of like, you know, maybe I could be a teacher. Like maybe this is what I could do full-time. I could be just like April. I could have my own program. And so when I went into college at College of the Canyons, there really wasn't a music ed program. There was barely mm-hmm. like a vocal program. It was like a cohort where you had like groups of classes that you had to take. So they were kind of in the baby steps of having a major. Mm-hmm. And so I was, I think, a freshman. I guess, do you do freshmen at COC? I was a freshman at College of the Canyons.
First year, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, like doing voice lessons and taking music mm-hmm. classes and sort of starting to develop those skills. But I think in my second year there, the program was not still running. So they were kind of in the bumpy early stages of trying to make a music program at the college, which mm-hmm. was fine because I ended up transferring out really quickly. I knew I didn't want to be there to get stuck there. Sure. I had bigger plans. And so my mm-hmm. goal when I got to College of the Canyons was save money, get out of here quickly.
Yep.
But I did a few performances at COC. I performed with their jazz band. I did a lot of opera scenes. Like that's where I realized like, oh, actually like maybe my classical voice is where my strength is and not so much my Broadway voice. And so mm-hmm. that was really awesome and kind of helped guide me toward what I ended up doing at Cal State Northridge afterward.
One of the things that you mentioned was that you had kind of this sense of wanting to get out from the COC process. And can you expand a little bit about that? Like what you kind of mean by you wanted to get out?
So my boyfriend at the time in high school was like top of everything, super smart. He went to mm-hmm. UCLA, like went to a great school. And I didn't really feel like the counselors had that same vision for me. So I wasn't necessarily encouraged to be like applying to colleges. And so by the time I was a junior, I was like, I'm just going to go to College of the Canyons, but I'm not going to be that person that spends 10 years there. Because I knew that if I didn't manage my class schedule, be in charge of myself, like I wasn't going to finish college. And that was a really hard thing for me. Like I didn't have a ton of support I felt at the time from my parents, and they couldn't, it's not their fault. They couldn't give me the support that I needed. And so I knew if I'm going to get through college, I'm really going to have to do it myself.
One of the things that I kind of keyed into there was you were saying that the counselors you felt weren't very encouraging for at least applying to four-year schools and stuff like that. And that's something that I kind of experienced the same way, because my brother is a scientist, and you know, he ended up getting his degree in astrophysics from Vanderbilt. That's where he got his PhD. And so the counselors very much treated me similarly, where it was just like, do the math and science. I'm like, I'm an artist. You know, I'm a singer, I'm an actor and stuff like that. Do you feel like that was something like a missed opportunity while you're in high school to really try to help find those programs that would fit for someone that's not necessarily focused on the core academics?
Gosh, I mean, it feels like it was a really long time ago now. Like my experience was more that based on my grades, and I was a fine student. I wasn't an incredible student, but I was a fine student. Like based on my grades, based on, you know, my elective choices, what I was doing, I didn't feel like a counselor looked at me and was like, that girl's going to a four-year university and we're going to just send her on her way. You know, sure. And so it felt like the conversations that we did have kind of were geared toward like, well, have you thought about going to College of the Canyons? Like, have you thought about? And I was like, oh, sure. Like, I don't have any plans. I'll just do that.
So once you got to CSUN, tell me a little bit about that. Was that strictly you're going into like a music ed program, or were you going into just like a regular teaching program?
So I went specifically, I think I started as a vocal, so I auditioned as a vocal performance major.
Okay.
Because their ed program is incredible, and it's usually harder to get into. Okay. Whether that's teaching ed, music ed, like any of their ed programs, like Cal State Northridge is known for putting out great teachers.
Sure.
So when I auditioned as a vocal performance major, and in my first semester, I changed to a music ed major.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I knew going in that I was going to need some kind of music. Like there was no path for me that didn't involve music when I went to Northridge.
Gotcha. What was the program like? Because I don't think that that's something that kids today know too much about, what the process is like getting into being a teacher. Can you share a little bit about your experience?
When you join a music ed program, your class schedule looks a lot different than when you're there as a vocal or just a strict performance major. You have to take piano classes, voice classes, have to take diction classes. So you'll do Italian, German. You'll do, if you're a voice major, you'll do French diction as well.
Okay.
Which is learning how to sing a language. Like learn what the language is, you learn how to sing the language.
Right.
Then you'll have your private voice lessons, and then you'll have all of your pedagogy classes. So even though I knew that I had a choral emphasis and that's what I wanted to do, I had to take percussion methods, brass methods, woodwind methods, some string methods, in addition to vocal pedagogy, choral conducting, and instrumental conducting. So when you're going in as a music educator, you have your specialty, but you absolutely have to take every single other class, which currently I'm thankful for and I can explain later, but it saved my butt. Who knew? So that's where you start. As a music educator, you have to take everything and you have to be able to do everything. And honestly, it was so much fun. My percussion pedagogy class was my favorite class ever. Getting to like play snare drums and who, you know, voice major, who would have known?
Right.
Yeah. And I knew too, like, so my mom worked at CSUN. She was an administrative assistant in the psychology department. And so I knew when CSUN's choir, when the Northridge Singers won Choir of the World. And so I was I need to be in that choir. And I think that helped make the experience so much better too. So I was in Northridge Singers for two and a half years that I was in the program. Cause you have to also keep performing. So you have to join a choir, an orchestra, or the band or the jazz band as well. Like if you're a music ed major. And I believe my second semester at College of the Canyons, might have been my second semester, second year, is when Lori Marie Rios joined the staff. And that's when I joined her choir. And performing with her choir was incredible. I think honestly that she was a huge reason why it was cemented in me that I wanted to be a choral music educator was being a student in her choir and how different it was from high school. And I'm not saying different as in bad versus good, just
right.
She really challenged us to be musicians. And that felt like the first time that we kind of were challenged to do that. At Saugus, I felt like if I was going to learn theory, I was in charge of doing it by myself. And with Lori Marie, it was expected. It was part of how we were in choir. And I think that changed and is probably part of my teaching influence today and how important I think learning sight reading, sight singing, music theory is for a choral student. It's not just about singing and developing beautiful tone. You have to be able to read music as well.
And I think that's one of the interesting things. I remember when Lori Marie joined the faculty at COC, and I remember she and I had a few conversations about the difference because she came from a high school background teaching at La Quinada High School and just the difference between college and high school. Because as you know, in high school, you're there every day. You said it, you know, we're there at lunch, we're there after school, after hours, in the morning. We saw each other 5 days a week all the time. But in college, it's a little bit less. Usually it's less time consuming because you're working around all the other things. You're an adult, so you've got a full-time job. Do you think that that's something that played into it? We didn't have the, you know, on Monday, okay, Monday was a rough day. I'm going to be better tomorrow. It's Tuesday, so I have another chance at it. Whereas in college, you know, it's like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or just Wednesdays. Do you think that that's something that played into it?
The expectation was in the collegiate choir that you are responsible for yourself. And so Lori Marie gave us the tools that we could sight read our music, we could learn our music on our own. And that was the expectation of the group, was that rehearsal is where we go to put together what we learned by ourselves. And outside of that time, you best be in a practice room. You best learn how to pound notes on a piano. Like, it is your responsibility to be teaching yourself your music. And then when you get to class, she would do the refining. She would correct vowels. She would add those consonants and things like that. So I think that was the first time that I had that flip of like, when you're in high school, there's only so much kind of independence that you do have control over. And it was like, it's August, we had three practice rooms, maybe, and they were constantly being used for sectionals. So you were never going to get private time in a practice room. And so, and learning on your own, like, if you didn't have a piano at home, where are you going to pound notes? And so we relied on things like tapes and recordings of parts and things like that, which
back in the day it was tapes. Well, because like, you said tapes, and it's like, I know they were tapes at the time because that was the technology that we had many years ago.
I know, it's so funny, and I laugh because I think of like, if she didn't rewind the tape all the way before she started recording, you would get like a piece of another recording for a different song, and just she would mess up and be like, just go with it. And I'm like, as a teacher now, I absolutely understand that mentality when you've been recording something for an hour and you're like, I am so fed up of playing the same piece 100 times to get it perfectly right for the kid.
So you've kind of hinted on that Lori Marie played a good influence on you as a future teacher. I feel like April Dooley was similar. Any other influences that you had or anything else you want to go into a little bit in depth, you know, sharing with them like, hey, I want to be a teacher. Did they help you along the way?
So one of those people was actually one of my other college professors, Dr. Larry Stoffel. And I took his class, which was instrumental conducting. And with him was the first time I felt like maybe I could be good at this because he, you know, and he would make fun of me because he's like, your gesture is like a dancer. And you know, the differences between like orchestra and choir, you know, he's like, your gesture is like a dancer. You need to be firmer in your gesture. And it's one of those weird things where it's like, if you look at the college experience, we were doing that dorky stuff of like, when you're learning conducting gesture, you want to sweep your hands up the wall and down the wall. And it feels like something out of a movie. Like, it doesn't feel real at all. And you're sitting there like, yeah, I believe this. This is actually working. This is helping me so much. And you're painting with your hands. And I look back on it now and giggle, but honestly, it was so helpful in like releasing the tension that you naturally have in your hands. But Dr. Stoffel was an incredible teacher, and I'm so glad I had him. And we had, you know, all sorts of people at the college who were doing everything they could to make you feel like you were going to be successful. But yeah. I would say the big ones for me, like Lori Marie, certainly. And then April, when I was kind of just starting out. I think those were the big two. And I have newer mentors now as a teacher myself, because I'm always looking up to someone who's doing it better, making it better. And one day I will hope to pass that torch down. But right now, sure. I feel like a young enough teacher that I'm still kind of looking up.
I got you. So going into that, I know some people know a little bit of the process of becoming a teacher, like an English teacher or something like that. I don't think everyone knows how difficult it is to become a teacher in the arts. Share with us a little bit about some of the, you know, the trials and tribulations that you had becoming a teacher, specifically a teacher in the arts.
So when you are doing an arts program, so I was an English teacher for a while. I do have kind of a unique experience that I've done both. If you join a state school to become a music educator, what's really wonderful about it is you take so many pedagogy classes as part of your degree that you don't have to take the CSET, which is the California State Teachers Exam on your subject area, single subject credential. So for me, I didn't have to take the big teacher exam because I took all those classes and I had such good grades, and I didn't have to do that. Thank goodness. It's an incredibly difficult and challenging test. I did have to take the English version, which was horrendous. Good Lord, that was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. It was harder than any SAT, harder than anything was that exam to become a credited or a credentialed English teacher. But so those are your two paths. You can be a music educator by taking a music education specific program. A lot of the programs don't require to take you the single subject credential exam. Or you can just be a music major or any major really. And if you are proficient, you can just take the test yourself. So if I wanted to, yeah, it's kind of strange. So that's how I became an English teacher. I had enough English classes in college that I qualified to just take the exam, and I had to teach myself the pedagogical aspects of being an English teacher. You could technically do the same thing if you wanted a credential in music. I might argue that the pedagogy, you're trying to catch up on the pedagogy, would be way more challenging than doing just a music ed specific program.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Just for our listeners and our viewers and stuff like that, can you explain what pedagogy is?
Oh, yeah. Pedagogy is the learning of teaching. So it's gotcha. Learning how to teach. So when okay. I said that I took a vocal pedagogy class, I learned basically how to give voice lessons mm-hmm. and how to teach students to produce good tones safely on the part of right. their body where they literally can't see anything that's going on. You know, exactly. if I were going to teach someone how to throw a football, you can look at their elbow, you can look at their shoulder, you can kind of teach them to see what they're doing. And in vocal development, it's not so easy beyond what you can see your mouth doing. So you can't control, you can't see what you're trying to control, like inside your body, essentially.
And I think that's something that, again, I think that there's a lot of misconceptions about it. I think people feel like, oh, you're a good singer, or oh, you're a good piano player. You could teach people how to sing. Because I've had people ask me, they're like, hey, give me voice lessons. I don't know how to teach you what it is that I know or how to do it, because I don't want to be responsible for teaching bad techniques. So I'm glad to hear that that's a big emphasis as a music education major, is that you're learning all those proper techniques so that you're not inadvertently causing harm to the next.
I took those pedagogy classes for how to play brass instruments, how to do, you know, the whole spectrum. And so as a person who had never really held an instrument ever, because mm-hmm. I played piano, and you don't get to hold your piano, you know,
no,
so many things going on there, but it was nice to be a student who'd literally never done it, because I have to teach beginners. And as a beginner learner, it was very easy to see challenges and things like that. So I think a good music program, especially CSUN's music program, will give you those tools that you need to be able to teach any subject area. Like, I even took jazz methods. So I had wow. to learn how to appropriately scat and you sing in jazz style, which is totally different from opera. Those yes. two are not friends in any way.
No, they are not. So then what was the process like? You said that you were an English teacher. How did you get the transition from teaching English to teaching more focused on music and choral studies?
So when I graduated, I graduated from college in 2011, and then I did a year of my credential program. So even when you're a music ed major, your bachelor's does not guarantee, I guess, depending on the program, your bachelor's does not guarantee you a credential. You have to take a credentialing program. And in that program is where you're going to learn more of the broader challenges of being a teacher. So teaching students who don't speak English as their first language, teaching students from poorer areas and the trials that come with being a student in poverty or being a student experiencing homelessness. You learn all of the child psychology and kind of teaching theory that comes along with that. And so when you're taking your credential program is when you're going to learn kind of an overview of teaching versus your music ed program, which is going to be specific to music. So once I finished that program and had a credential, that's where I took that English exam. Because when I finished my credential in 2012, we were in the like bottom of the recession and teachers were getting pink slipped and no one was getting jobs. And so for me to graduate like fresh faced and ready to be like, by the way, if you want a job, you have to move to Carson City, Nevada. I was like, cool. I can't do that. So when I first got into the teaching world, I didn't have an English credential yet. I just had my music credential. I was like, I'm not going to sell out. I'm not going to be another teacher. It's not a music teacher. Liar. And so what I did instead is I was a substitute teacher. And during that time, I was a sub for 2 years. During that time, I worked on studying for my exam because I wanted to be hireable. And honestly, if I had not gotten my English credential, I would not have gotten a job.
Yeah.
So I'm very thankful for that.
So you mentioned that, you know, when you're first getting into the teaching world, that there was like opportunities like Carson City, Nevada. Did you have a decision that you wanted to stay within Santa Clarita, or did you want to teach outside of our community? You know, what kept you home, as it were?
I knew from growing up in the Heart District that it was a district that I would want to teach at. And I think that was a huge drive in why I stayed and why I was willing to be a substitute teacher in the Heart District, because that's where I did my sub work. I wanted to get to know people. I wanted to sort of make connections and hear about jobs early and things like that. Like, I needed to find a way to get in. And so I stayed locally because we owned a house and we couldn't leave, but also because I knew it was a really good school district. And that I, if I had the opportunity to teach in it, that I wanted to take it. Especially because I wanted, you know, knowing that April came from our district and how great the schools are, I was like, well, someone will retire eventually. Maybe that will be my opportunity. And I'll just try to keep getting sub and teaching experience until then. And so that was why I couldn't leave. I could have, you know, if I wasn't married, if we didn't own a house, the marriage thing, whatever, but if we didn't own a house, then I could have just gone wherever I wanted.
Right. But like you said, you knew being an alumnus of the Heart District, you knew the caliber of teachers there were, you knew what the students were and stuff like that. So obviously you felt like there was something that you wanted to help contribute, if you would, to that next generation of learners.
Yeah. And like, Santa Clarita was a really great place to grow up. And I, at the time, I didn't really want to leave. I was like, no, I really like it here, you know? And so that helped drive that decision as a really young person with a lot of responsibilities and needing to find a job, that it was like, well, I've got to make it work. So I waited tables. I was a substitute teacher. I taught for a semester at a private school. I did anything I could to kind of keep up my teaching experience until I finally got my full-time teaching job, which was in 2014.
Walk us through, what's the typical day like as a music teacher at a junior high?
Okay, so junior high is one of those things where when you tell people that you're a junior high teacher, they go like, oh my God, I don't know how you do that. That's like, ooh, more power to you. And I sit here and I'm like, I don't understand the problem. I love them. I love teaching junior high. The kids are silly. They're excited to be at school, most of them. But yeah, so the typical day. Last year I started teaching choir and bands. Thankful for my music pedagogy right there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it starts like when you're this is going to sound so dorky. When you're the music teacher, your kids think you're a cool teacher. I like to think. I can be totally wrong. Which means from the second I unlock my door, I have students in my room until I kick them out when I leave at 5 o'clock. Like, I want to go home, children. I love you, but you need to go. And so when I get to school, probably around 6:45, open that door. I've got kids in my room. They are either getting out their instruments and warming up or practicing or playing, depending upon what class period is first. I have a couple of kids who will play the old piano that I have in my room that they're not allowed to touch my teacher piano. I have kids in there who are filming TikTok videos. I have kids in there who are just chatting with their friends or eating snacks on the floor. Like, it's just kind of a hangout space until bell rings. And it depends what class I'm teaching. So when the kids come in for band class, they are in the first 5 minutes, they're setting up their instruments, they're tuning, they're warming up. And then we'll do kind of group warm-ups and scales, a little bit of theory, and then we'll focus on our music for the remainder of the class period, whether that's like specific sections, polishing whole pieces. Occasionally, we'll pull out the percussion section since they tend to have less to do and they tend to not be highlighted as much. And that would be like my advanced band. That might be the pattern of how we go through our class period. For beginning band, it's a lot of, I'm not on the podium. I am adjusting posture. I am fixing instruments. I feel like my whole life is repairing lightly broken instruments or telling kids to throw away reeds that are not playable. It's a lot of posture. Like, nope, you got to be sitting up straight, adjusting music stands, things like that.
I feel like I should be sitting up straight now that you're calling it out.
Even when I said that, I was like, I shut my shoulders.
I know, right? We went into our 13 points of posture that we learned.
Oh God, 13, unnecessary. Right. So yeah, like posture, hand positions, embouchures, all about how your mouth is shaped and playing your instrument. Lots of warming up, like I'll be trying to conduct a warm up and changing a pad in an instrument or, you know, getting new reeds or doing whatever. So band for me is very hectic. And also it's only my next year, this is just the end of my first year teaching band. And so I'm still learning how to appropriately take care of those things. Versus the choir class, we warm up. So when the kids walk in the door, they're already working on their theory. We do a daily written theory exercise. We do sight reading and sight singing. And then we'll do vocal warm-ups and we'll focus on, in that time, producing vowels, really good vowels. And vocal tone at a junior high level is maybe you're in like the baby steps, the baby levels, especially because their voices are cracking, boys and girls, doesn't matter. Their voices are cracking all over the place. Like, you're basically just trying to strengthen the very, very weak foundation a lot of those kids already have, especially if they're not the type of kids to be taking music lessons or voice lessons. And then in my beginning band or my beginning choir classes, we'll focus a lot on how to harmonize by doing rounds and partner songs, just kind of introductory, like, how does that sound? How does that feel hearing harmonies? And then my advanced choir, we're doing 3-part harmony, occasionally 4-part harmony. And that's where we'll get, if we're lucky enough to have boys, we'll have a few kind of baritones in there. They're either singing soprano or they're a baritone and there's not a whole lot of space in between. And at 13, that's just what you're dealing with. And so we'll be working on harmonizing in 3 parts and really trying to build strength and help kids listen. That's a really hard thing at this age, is like, don't just listen to yourself. Listen to the people across the room. Listen to the baritones. We should all be harmonizing or tuning based on that low note, that baritone. And then I have an intro to music class and we just do kind of fun music activities and music history stuff and found sounds, just kind of basic. And then after school, I have an after school jazz band. And then my advanced band would do after school sectionals once a week where the high schoolers would come down and help out and help the kids learn the more complicated festival music. Yeah. And honestly, I kind of had to do that. I'm a great musician. I'm a great sight reader, but I haven't had to play a lot of these instruments. And so I talked to the high school director, Stephen Hufford, who's incredible. And I was like, hey, like, do you have seniors who want to be teachers? Do you have kids who are interested in becoming educators that want to run sectionals? And they get hours towards their music honor society. I think it's Tri-M. I'm not. Yeah, okay. That sounds right. And so the high schoolers would come, and I had a high school assistant, and she would come after school and help conduct my class, help run sectionals. Like I want to build this program of helping kids who are seniors and want to be educators come and get an opportunity to have time in front of a class. Sure. And actually get to teach. And I started it this year a little bit more to kind of figure out what it is I should be doing. And now next year that I have a better idea of that, next year we'll get to that, but in a few years, maybe kind of turn it into something a little more educational for that senior student, where sure. I can actually help them with conducting and gesture and things like that. So I really want to do a big and little situation. We talked about it before, but from the high school to the junior high, because not only does it help my kids, it helps them want to stay in band when they go up to the high school. And that's a huge part. I mean, maybe one of the biggest parts of my job is recruitment, getting kids to want to join, getting kids to want to stay in high school. And keeping the program alive, because it gets harder and harder, you know, in junior high, they get one elective.
One of the things you mentioned, your classroom opens up 6:45 ish. You're there all through the day. You know, there's this misconception that teachers, they work, you know, Monday through Friday, you know, from first bell to last bell. But I feel like, and you're obviously hinting that you have after school stuff, that it's not as cut and dry as everyone likes to say. When you're not at school, how much of your free time, if you will, is focused on, you know, coming up with future stuff for your students?
This past year has been a year, and I don't think, like, I don't know, even before I switched to full-time music, I was a person who was at school for a long time. Like an sure. average day for me is probably 6:30 or 6:45 to 4:30 or 5 o'clock. And that's not constant. When it's festival season, then it's suddenly sure. I'm out doing concerts till 9 p.m. And it gets a little more crazy than that. But I would say I tried really hard to do everything that I had to do during the week so that I could have that time off on the weekends when I'm not, you know, doing honor band, or I'm not at a festival, or I'm not doing those kind of things. And I have kids physically in my room for activities, sectionals, jazz band, until 3:30, 4 o'clock. Mm-hmm. On the days that I don't have those, so that's Mondays and Wednesdays, I'm at school till 4 o'clock no matter what. Right. On Tuesdays, we have staff meetings. I'm the department chair as well. So I will be in a department chair meeting, you know, leadership once a month. So I'll have those two. And so Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm at school probably till 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock without doing extra work. Right. And then throw in, like, I have my prep period during the day. So I try to get that 45 minute chunk of, like, make music copies, do like theory, like copy off kids theory, copy off like activities, do lesson planning, also practice. Because in addition, like, I have to be keeping up my piano skills. I have to reteach myself how to play the flute. I just got a clarinet. That's what I'm spending summer doing. And I've got a trombone over here, and I have a saxophone over here. And so I'm trying to be at a place where I am beyond my beginning band in every instrument they could possibly play. So when you add in your practice hours, plus your planning hours, plus just sectionals and things for the students, like, it would not be uncommon for me to work an 11 or 12 hour day, 4 or 5 days a week. And I tried to, like, give myself Fridays. But here's the thing about Fridays: everybody wants to leave. So, like, the staff room is quiet and everything is quiet, and it's, like, the best time to get work done. And so I'm like, we're going out on Fridays because I'm going to be at school until 6.
Right.
That's the nature. I might be not the example. That's probably not true. There are directors who leave earlier than me, I'm sure. But I'm late. I focus better when I'm at school and not at home, where I can be easily distracted.
Understandable. One of the things that I like that you've said is that, you know, you've got kids in there hanging out and, you know, eating snacks and stuff like that. What have you done to help kind of develop that welcoming part of being a teacher, and especially in the arts, because I feel like you and I can both talk about this, because, you know, we were those kids in high school. We were in the choir room all the time because we felt comfortable. What is it that you think about the arts that is so welcoming? And what is it that you specifically do to try to create that welcoming environment?
So I think it helps that by its nature, your art class is kind of your fun class. Like,
sure,
it's a little bit less strict in that, like, you're not going to have a state test on your trumpet. Yep. And so I think that already brings down the level of like it's a little bit more casual. But even when I was an English teacher, I always had kids in my room. And I think, like, this is going to make me sound like a 1,000-year-old, but I try to, like, learn what the kids are doing. So, like,
I'm
probably half as addicted to TikTok as my kids are. I love it. And here's the thing is, like, when you make the effort to understand what they love, as much as they'll go like, oh my God, Mrs. Mary, you like TikTok? They secretly love it. Because what'll happen is you'll catch on to the little phrases and things that they use. And when you start to, like, laugh or throw them back, like, it gives you, like, credit with the kids that, like, oh, she cares about us. She cares about what we like. And also, like, I would take my lunch out in the very beginning. I would take my lunch out and I would eat with the kids, like, sit on the floor, eat with the kids. And I still think in junior high, the kids look at their teacher as like, oh, at the end of the day, she powers down in the closet and never leaves. Like, she's the one that lives in this room. like, you know, elementary school, you see your teacher like at the mall and you're like, oh, who is this? She's outside of her room.
That's very true.
I think there's still elements of that. And like, as a teacher, when I see my students, I'm like, oh my God, it's you. And I make a huge deal out of it. They hate me and I love it. You know, they want to be cool. They don't want their teacher to recognize them in public. And I'm like, no way. Like, I'm going to point it out to you first thing. And I think that's a huge part of it, is that if you want to, you have to be on their level a little bit. And if you're willing to be dorky, if you're willing to, like, learn a dumb dance, that goes a long way in terms of, like, social credit with your students.
Sure.
I think the other part of it too is that there are these education programs that allow you to text message with your students in a way that they don't know your phone number and you don't know theirs.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, and Remind, it's called Remind. It has been so helpful to me in terms of not only just, like, telling students about things that are going on, but, like, I'll send out, like, a funny choir meme to the choir kids, or, like, band memes and things like that. And I think the more you can laugh with your students outside of the classroom setting, they're more comfortable with you when they're inside the classroom setting. And it builds this rapport where you can be like, hey, student, if you just adjust your posture this way, you're going to have stronger notes. And I think it lets you give constructive criticism in a way that's not hurtful when they trust you already on that level.
Sure.
And that's the best part of teaching, is to getting to know 150, like, these little personalities before they kind of fully grow into who they think they're going to be. And they're silly and they like dumb jokes. And I'm here for that, because that's my brand of humor.
It sure is.
And I think, you know, that's a huge part of it. And honestly, like, if we want to talk about inclusivity in the classroom, I'm going to a training in July that is all about how do we give diverse populations in our classrooms a stronger voice. And I'm really excited to do that. And I think that that's something that we really need to focus on, is that where we live is not incredibly diverse right now. It's certainly more diverse than it was when we were young, like, even in high school then until now. Like, it certainly has changed. But I have a huge Latino population at my school. And I'm not a Latino person. And so I don't know. And actually, I'm sorry, I should correct myself, Latinx. I don't, that's not my culture. And so it's like, how can I be a better supporter of the culture of my school? And, you know, including my students so that they can celebrate themselves beyond just what I am doing as an educator and a carer, a nurturer of loving them and letting them in my classroom and letting them get to know me. And so I think that's going to be a huge drive of what I spend my summer doing. Cause, like, here's the other thing. This is my first time having a summer off in a decade. I have taught summer school every single year of my teaching career, just about. And I'm looking forward to actually taking the time to have time to improve myself as a teacher, which is a constant drive. I think if you're going to be a good teacher, you have to be a good learner. And that's mm-hmm. something that you need to be doing throughout your entire career. It's not just like, I'm here, I'm done. If you're not participating in professional development in your subject area, you are never going to be as good a teacher as you were your first time out, which, oh, by the way, first year teachers are notoriously not good because they haven't learned yet, which is why they have this period of trial that we let them learn and we help them learn. Mm-hmm. So that was a very wiggly thing to say that, like, I don't think I'm even doing enough to amplify the diverse voices in my classroom. And that's my goal for the summer, is to be better about things like that.
Let's dive into that just a little bit, if you can. You and I, we grew up on the Saugus side of town, and it's made up of a certain demographic. You said you have a very high Latinx student population at your school. At my school, it's the exact same thing. What have you noticed that's different between how arts are regarded where we grew up versus where you're teaching, even within still being Santa Clarita?
I think that opportunity is mm-hmm. a big part of what separates the kids who went to Arroyo Seco and Saugus versus the kids who come to Sierra Vista. So, like, we have a big Latinx population. We are a little bit lower on the socioeconomic scale than mm-hmm. Arroyo Seco or Saugus. And in terms of music, that means that these students tend to only get their music education from school.
Right.
They're not taking private lessons. They're not in the Santa Clarita Youth Orchestra. They're not in the, you know, the children's choir, which there really isn't one anymore. These right. students are far more likely to have sung in church, mm-hmm. done after school band or choir at their elementary school. And certainly they are less likely to have access to an instrument, a lesson, things like that. So, like, for my students, I am their music education provider. Mm-hmm. I provide them an instrument. I provide them education. I provide all of that, and through the school, obviously. And I think that's a big thing when you talk about, you know, Santa Clarita is shaped like a V, right? If we have the 5 on this side and the 14 on this side, this tends to mm-hmm. be lower socioeconomic and this tends to be higher socioeconomic, obviously, with exceptions. And so your kids from Rancho Pico, West Ranch are more likely to have the funds to have a private music education versus the kids at Sierra Vista or at Canyon. Obviously, I am generalizing. Obviously, we still have Sand Canyon. We still have little pockets of more like upper socioeconomic families. But overall, I would say that's the barrier, really, is opportunity and access in terms of just money, just paying. Like, getting private lessons is really expensive. I couldn't afford it when I was, you know, young. Mm-hmm. I had piano lessons because our next door neighbor would give them to me for free. So it's that thing of, and I went to Arroyo Seco, you know, and I think things have changed a little bit since we were there. Sure. But opportunity is a big one. And, you know, people will complain about the school has to provide everything. Like, we can't even ask kids to bring pencils. And it's like, yeah, you may laugh at that, but for some of our families, that's genuinely a concern and an issue. And so how are mm-hmm. we going from they can't afford to bring their own pencil to, oh, by the way, they want to play the clarinet. And that means renting an instrument for $20 a month and purchasing reeds and caring of the instrument. If something's broken, they're responsible. So all those things, like, it's dollar signs. Yeah. So if we don't have these programs, we're not giving kids music education.
Yeah. And that's something that, like, I experienced, you know, part of the reason for myself going into the choral program as a theater kid, like, musical theater wasn't really my thing as a kid because I wasn't a singer. And I looked at choir as being like free voice lessons. Because that's basically what it was. Obviously, there was our tour and, you know, there were those fees that went along with it. But it wasn't like you said, paying for private lessons. That just kind of adds up. So let's dive into that a little bit. What's the funding been like for the arts programs? Where are our struggles? What can we get better on? I know this is it's a touchy subject, but it's something that needs to get talked about because, as you and I both know, and most people know, the arts is usually the first thing that when budgets come out, they go, we don't need this anymore. So what are some of the struggles that you've seen in your teaching career in the arts?
So until Sierra Vista became, and I've only taught at Sierra Vista, so this is okay. My entire teaching career. I was a sub at lots of other schools, but Sierra Vista has been my home for 6 years. My program is 100% funded by fundraising. So until we became a Title I school, I run an ice cream shop at lunch. I get parent volunteers and student workers, and all the profits from that shop help pay for festival fees, buses, tickets, like that music, like that funds my entire program. And we're talking like $3,000 a year, maybe, is what is what we'll make from that shop. And that's if we get all the parent volunteers we can, because it's a lot to ask. Like, can you come for 1 hour or 1 day a week? But you have to do 6 weeks of training before you're allowed to be on campus to do that. So
interesting.
For me, my choir was run entirely through this ice cream shop.
Okay.
And we had to pay for the parents to get fingerprinted, because obviously you have to.
Oh, right. That aspect.
Yeah. You have to be fingerprinted and get background checks in order to be allowed to work with students on campus. Not complaining about that. It's 100% necessary. It's just an obstacle. It's, you know, $500 a year that I have to pay for through with our $3,000 budget, if I'm lucky to get that much. So since we became a Title I funded school, which means we have enough students of need that the government gives us extra money to fund our programs, it has been slightly easier where I can ask Title I to pay for certain things. And this became essential to me for the band program. So I could use Title I to buy new instruments. I could use Title I to pay for instrument repair, which is a huge, huge budgetary problem, especially when it's like the school owns these instruments, but my program has to pay for them and their upkeep individually. That's thousands of dollars a year. So that's crazy. Plus any festival entrance fees. We're talking about reeds. We're talking about new ligatures. We're talking about just new cases when cases are broken or damaged. It's funding these programs is incredibly expensive. And sadly, it's done almost 100% through self-fundraising. And the students, like, imagine telling your student, like, oh, you're going to work really hard to sell these chocolate bars or to sing these valigrams. And the money is going to go to buying a new trumpet case. It's not exactly like glamorous. And so it's the fundraising is the hardest part. And it's even harder because you, with our population, it feels really unfair to ask the parents to be the ones giving the money. So most of our fundraisers are that ice cream shop, chocolates, and concerts. And concerts are free, but we'll have like a bake sale. And so that's where we'll make a majority of our funds from that. I've been really trying to incorporate technology, which was something I was extremely passionate about as an English teacher. And it feels easier a lot of the time. But any good sight reading program has a per student cost, a yearly fee. And so it's like, if I want my kids to be doing sight reading at home in addition to at school, and I want to use something like Smart Music or Sight Reading Factory, any of those, like, even that's a cost. And you have to be like, hey, can I get Chromebooks for my classroom? Like, it's, if you're trying to bring your program into the 21st century, those costs add up as well. And you know, that's the thing that I'm lucky that Title I will most likely pay for this year, especially after we got to pilot it when we were shut down for COVID. And so I have a better idea of what will work for my students. But anything you want basically you have to take from the frame of mind of like, okay, what do I have to do to raise the money for it? How much work is it for my students? And how much does it benefit a majority of my students? It's really hard to think on that. Like, oh, well, like five kids will play this trumpet every 5 years versus, well, this piece of music is going to be sung, you know, 20 times. So you have to like weigh it. And, you know, my fundraising woes are why a lot of teachers are getting into trouble for like copyright infringement when they photocopy music, which is, you know, not fair to the publishers. And that was a big thing when I came here, was like, no, I don't want to photocopy music. Like, I want to pay for the music that I need. And you're talking about $50 to $100 per piece of music, or per song, I should say.
Yeah.
So It's a lot of little things that add up really fast. And what ends up happening is like, I'm buying folders with my own money and I'm buying pencils and I'm doing stuff like that, because it's like easier to just do it myself and spend the money than like beg for it, fundraise for it, wait for Title I to approve it.
I believe it's Oprah says that there's those little aha moments or anything like that. Have you had moments with your students, whether it's in a group setting, whether it's one-on-one interactions with a student, where you just get that feeling and you're like, this is why I got into the profession that I'm in. I'm so happy to be doing this. If there's any examples that come to mind, I would love to hear them.
So a lot of what teaching is feels like saying the same thing a thousand times and not getting any different results. Like the kids will be able to parrot your phrases back to you within a month of being in your classroom. And I think my biggest aha moment, the group of advanced choir kids that I just recently just graduated, their tonality, their intonation was really strong. And I was like, I think I can get these students to sing a cappella well. And so I think, and a lot of kids, like, they want pop music. I totally get that. And I'm such a traditionalist that I'm like, I know they like it. I know they need it. I just need to do it. But I am such a person that's like, oh my God, I hate it. I don't like it. My thing. That's the thing I need to change. But we did Carol of the Bells.
Okay.
And here's the thing about Carol of the Bells. It's so accessible. The kids love it. If you know it's a thing that they already love, it's like, oh my gosh, not only can I teach so much better with this, the students are only going to come out of it with positive feelings and therefore want to do it more. So when we started school, so after singing Carol of the Bells a cappella, all the advanced choir kids were like, oh my God, that was so amazing. This experience was so incredible. And I'm sitting here going like, oh my God, thanks. when they came back in January, all they wanted was to try a cappella music. And so I'm sitting here like, oh my gosh, if I can find that thing that they already like and twist it just a little bit so it's the thing that I want to do, then we can all be happy in this, situation. But I think the biggest thing that I have learned so far in my career, which I'm not modeling to you right now as I'm just talking incessantly, is talk less, play more. Talk less, sing more. Anything you teach can be taught through song. Anything you teach can be taught through an instrument. If you have to explain it with your words more than you can demonstrate it, you're probably not doing it right. And it's taken me a really long time to understand that. And so that has been a huge change of like, and as a choir person, that means get away from the piano. Don't use the piano as your crutch. Don't correct notes. You need to teach the students to correct them vocally. Don't correct them on the piano. Don't sing for your kids in that way. Like, I teach my students solfege so that when they read a piece of music, they can have a by looking at it, they can hear how it sounds before they sing it.
Right.
And I'm even working on teaching the band students that, because like, you can hold down all the appropriate keys or cover the appropriate holes to play a D, but if your instrument is not put together appropriately, that can still be out of tune. And so it's like, you need to teach your kids intonation. They need to hear it before you can say it, essentially. And so that's been a huge thing for me, is like, don't use the piano as a crutch. Sing everything, sing it as much as you can, make the students sing it. If they are singing for as much of the class period as they possibly can be, like, you're doing your job right, because you're going to strengthen their voices and they're going to love it even more if they can just sing, 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 play, 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 play. Like, even if it sounds bad, it doesn't matter. Just you're doing it. And so that was a huge thing that I learned as an educator, of like, stop talking, start playing.
I really like that. That's a good piece of advice. So 10, 15 years down the line, is there somewhere you want to see either your program grow? Do you want to see yourself as an educator grow? Like, would you like to transition into the high school level or something like that and just expand what you're doing? What are your goals?
I love junior high and I have no plans of going up to high school. Like, honestly, I feel like I can do more with the junior higher between seventh and eighth grade as they go on to high school than I feel like maybe a lot of people would think you could do between freshman and senior year of high school. And I think a lot of that is because you're starting with nothing and then giving them this music education. And honestly, I'm sure a lot of high school people would totally disagree with me. My philosophy, I understand. But I feel like you can do so much with junior high kids in such a short amount of time. And it's so rewarding as an educator and so rewarding for the students. And then you send them off to high school, and high school is where they can do more of that refining vocal development kind of stuff. And so my goal as an educator always is to create that music theory foundation, reading notes, reading rhythms. That is my goal, is to make sure that they have such a strong foundation in that, that when they go up to high school, they have much easier access to the music itself, which is going to be way harder, you know, than they're used to. So I would say for me, in 15 years down the road, when I think about my program, I would love to be only band and choir and not have that intro to music class anymore, which I know is probably a little bit blasphemous to say, but when I think about what I want choir and band, and I'm considering after school jazz band, after school jazz choir. So I would get kind of a split of doing all of that. And the reason why I say after school and not during school is that because they can only choose one elective, if I have kids that choose jazz choir over my like advanced choir, they can't do both. Right. So my goal is give more opportunities to students to experience different types of music.
Sure.
And then just to get a handle on work-life balance, to be perfectly honest, I don't want my whole life to be 12-hour days on campus. I just personally, and so I know I'll get to a point where I'm more comfortable and I'm better at backwards planning, like how my year is going to look, but I would love that skill to develop a little bit faster. And to be perfectly honest, I'm like education obsessed. I love going to PD. I love learning new teaching methods and strategies. And so I will constantly be learning. And as an educator, I think that's an essential, is that you need to be constantly teaching yourself and staying up to date and trying new things. And so, you know, I look forward to that just as much as I look forward to teaching the kids. And sometimes you learn these things and you bring them to your students and you fall flat on your face and you're like, well, I failed. And what do we do when we fail? We try again. And so, you know, I think that's another important aspect too, is teach your kids it's okay to fail. Like, it's okay to fail. We can always try another time. But yeah, like, I don't want to go to the high school level. I don't want to be a school administrator. I'm happy right now being a junior high school, you know, choir and band teacher.
If you could get into a time machine, hop back and give a piece of advice to young Brianna about, you know, pursuing this career or pursuing a career in the arts specifically, because usually this question is, you know, if you could give yourself or the next generation a piece of advice, but you're already kind of doing that as an educator. Like, that's a big part of what you're doing. So that's why I'm phrasing this to specifically to young Brianna. If you could go back in time, hop in the DeLorean and talk to, you know, your younger self, you know, what's a piece of advice that you would give her?
I would say perform more, because I got myself through school, but I had to work the whole time. So I was working full time and I was going to school, which meant that like, I couldn't do the opera production. I couldn't be in the musical theater. I couldn't do any of those things. Like, choir was pretty much the most I could handle on my work schedule. And so if I could go back and do it again, I think that being in those performances and joining those, like taking those opportunities, is so much more important. Perform more. If anything, I would go back and I would have double majored. I would have done performance and I would have done education, because you got way more complex theory training. You got way more performance opportunities. Like, I had one senior recital. I would have had a junior and a senior recital. Like, perform more. do more, because I think when you have performance experience, it helps you become a better educator. And then I would say maintain that. And that means, like, as a teacher, you should be taking your voice lessons. You should be taking piano lessons. You need to maintain your instrument. And your instrument is yourself, especially if you're a choral educator. And so to me, if you're not doing these PD courses and teaching yourself how to be a better teacher, you best be keeping up your performance ability, making sure that you're taking those piano lessons or doing that. I think that that's a thing that I didn't realize until way late in my young career. And if I could go back and do it again, I would have absolutely done all the theater, done all the performances, done literally everything and anything that you could to perform in different ways. You know, be a solo in front of a band, join a jazz combo, be in the choir, be in the musical theater, do the opera scenes, like do the whole thing so that you can get that variety of experience will just make you a more well-rounded and better educator.
I really like the, you know, maintain your own like lessons as a performer. It's one of the things I remember Laura Marie always talking about. She would always talk about, you know, I was at my voice teacher the other day and he's correcting me on this stuff. And Laura Marie, obviously for you and I and people who have studied under her, we hold her to a high regard. And it's nice to hear that someone that is so well respected in her industry is still constantly learning. And I think that's really nice that even though you said it's late in your early career, it's nice to hear that you've at least heard that you're trying to maintain that as you move forward as an educator. So I really appreciate you sharing that with us.
And it's going to be hard. Like, let me tell you, when you're in the throes of, you know, winter concert and you have, you know, dress rehearsal and rehearsal and extra rehearsals to try to kind of get there, the idea of practicing piano for piano lessons kind of sucks. And it's this thing of like, you're like, I have 100 things to do for my job. And it's like, well, your piano lessons are part of your job too. So I think it's a thing of like, you need to be constantly keeping up your own instrument so that you can be good for your kiddos as well. And that's a hard thing. And it's a big thing to say out loud. I just kind of got to put a fire under me to make sure I keep it up because it's not cheap either. And so it's like, hey, you got to make it a priority and you got to do it.
I know some of our questions got kind of in depth in policy and stuff like that. We do a good job comparatively to some other districts and some other schools and stuff like that for the arts. But there's obviously there's places more that we can go with making sure, like you said, it's the equitability of getting the arts into the hands of our students, especially those voices that need to be elevated, that need to be represented, that you have at your school, I have at my school. So I really appreciate that. That being said, I do really appreciate, Brianna, that you took time out to speak with me. I've loved seeing how you've grown as a person and as an educator since when I first met you all those years ago. I'm really proud of you and the work that you're doing. So keep it up. And thank you for joining me on Talking Backstage.
Yeah, thank you for having me. You know, people don't look at our job as terribly glamorous. And I think that once you decide it's what you want to do, the love of it kind of takes over all of the other more challenging parts. And there's nothing better than making music and for watching the joy of making music happen for the first time for my 12, 13, 14 year olds. And you know, when you see that spark, you can never get that again. There's no other way than the first time that a kid realizes like, hey, I'm making music. And I think that that's a high that you can chase for your entire career. And it's worth every second of the fundraising and weird pandemic issues that come along with being an educator. But thank you so much for having me. I mean, this has been a joy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I'll talk about school all day. It's my greatest love. So,
well, I appreciate that. Thanks for joining me here at the Newhall Family Theater. Until next time, I'm your host, Tom Lund. I'll see you backstage.